Well, I have a very special guest with me now who has two things to celebrate. It's the publication date of Susan Stamberg's new book, Every Night at Five, Susan Stamberg's All Things Considered book. And today is also the 11th anniversary of this award-winning news magazine, All Things Considered. For over 10 years of those 11 years, Susan Stamberg has been the co-host of the program. In 1971, she became the first woman anchor of a national daily news show, but that's not all that makes her a pioneer. In a national anchor position, authority is usually maintained through distance and formality, but Susan has changed the rules. She conveys warmth, personal concern, and involvement. And this gets communicated whether she's exploring the latest conflict in the Middle East or interviewing her favorite novelist. And she's been doing this on a program that has reexamined the question, what is news, and redefined how the news should be covered. Her work has been recognized with several awards. The 1977 Ohio University Honor Award cited her for, quote, pioneering humanistic selection of news and incisive interviewing techniques, causing the nation to rediscover listening in a visual age. In 1980, she received the annual Edward R. Murrow Award, which cited her as the individual most responsible for increasing the image, audience, awareness, and listenership of public radio. I've only met Susan briefly at conferences and radio functions, but I think like most of her listeners, I feel like I know her well. For me, Susan's interviews have been an education in how to speak with people and how to listen. Last year, Susan took a leave of absence from the show to write a book, and it's just been published with the title Every Night at Five, Susan Stamberg's All Things Considered book, and it's published by Pantheon. The book is a scrapbook of highlights from and reflections on a decade of All Things Considered. And Susan, congratulations on the anniversary of the show and the publication of your book.
Oh, Terry, who were you talking about? That was so lovely. My gosh, I'd like to meet her. What a good day this is, really.
Have you done a lot of interviews?
Oh, yeah, but I just mean about the program and the idea that All Things Considered has, in fact, survived 11 years when
it's amazing.
Earliest days we thought never, if we get through a week, if we get through a Tuesday, we'll be in great shape. 11 years, it's kind of scary.
I kind of wonder how you feel now being on the other side of the fence. You've interviewed so many book tour authors throughout the history of not only All Things Considered, but when you were working at WAMU in Washington, and now you're on a book tour yourself. Do you have a little mental list of do's and don'ts that
I really ought
require?
To, I suppose. Well, what they all do, they come in and they drop the name of their book all the time. So they conduct the interview as follows. Now, I'm the writer. I am not really Susan Stamberg. They say, well, Terry, as I say in my book, Every Night at Five, Susan Stamberg's All Things Considered book, and on page 12 of Every Night at Five, Susan Stamberg, and we, you know, we do that on tape, unlike you. We're live now, right?
But yeah, we're live now.
But All Things Considered is pretty much pre-recorded before it goes on the air. So we just get out our little razor blades, you know, and sort of snip out all of those free plugs. But that, for a long time, I thought that's what it meant to be a writer, that you just came on book tours and kept dropping the name of the book. So that's one thing I don't think is awfully important to do, and I'm trying not to myself. I don't know if this is, to me, This is not the working side of the microphone, Terry. You are on the working side of the microphone, and I'm still not at all comfortable sitting on this side of it.
You're not?
No, not particularly. Can I ask you a couple of questions?
No. When you started out on All Things Considered, it still wasn't really accepted, I think, that women could be in that authoritative position. A lot of people used to believe that no one would trust a woman reading the news, let alone interviewing newsmakers. Did you have resistance either from within or from the listeners?
I tell you, Bill Siemering, your station manager, to whom my book is dedicated, by the way, an extraordinary human being and a wonderful broadcaster, was telling me that apparently there was quite a bit of resistance at the beginning. They very kindly protected me from that. Maybe that's good management. I don't know. I didn't hear about it. And probably if I'd heard it, it would have shaken my confidence a lot and upset me greatly and changed in some way the way I broadcast. The objection in the beginning was, you don't sound like CBS, you new network. And his point was, that's right, because there is a CBS. We don't need to sound like that. We need to sound like real people. And some of us are women. They're real people, too. And they can certainly present information in a reliable and authoritative way. Terry, one of the greatest compliments that I ever got went to Linda Wertheimer and I about the first year after All Things Considered had gone on the air at a public radio conference, when one of the reporter from one of the stations thanked us for legitimizing the sound of women in serious news roles. You know, it hadn't occurred to us. That's how myopic and foolish we were. We hadn't thought about it. And I guess that's how generous the management was, not letting us know the kind of pressure maybe they were under to get us off. But that was very satisfying, to have other women say to us that we'd made a difference somehow. I think you can be human, and you can be female, and you can be a warm person who laughs on the radio. I mean, we're alike, that we're smart, and we're silly, and we get in trouble, and we get sad, and we get mad, and it's life, and why not be able to do that on the radio as we do across the table from each other?
I should think, in a way, it would be harder for a woman to do that starting off, because sometimes when women get started in a field, they have to really be like the men in order to be
That's
credible.
That's right. In fact, they have to be better, to tell you the truth. They have to work three times harder, and we all found that in the beginning, the things that were accepted from the men on the staff simply wouldn't have been by us. We had to do seven times more homework than the others and just work 100 times harder. And we did. But it was really worth it because it cleared the way. There are first-rate reporters with us now are women, and there are more and more women on television in news and more women in radio in news. There's you across this table. See?
Smokey, also known as John Bear, who's an editor who spent a number of years working with All Things Considered, once said to me that one of the things that happened to him working on the show for a long time was he started to see the world in terms of how long the feature on it would be. You know, like this city, 5 minutes.
Yes,
this
it's
person,
a good three minutes in the bottom of the third. That's right.
Has doing All Things Considered for over 10 years affected your worldview in any way like that?
Well, not in that kind of global way. I don't think so. I sort of try to avoid that. Here's how it works. First of all, we take the name of the program very seriously. We really do consider all things. And there's a story everywhere. So it's relentless pressure all the time. You know, you never know when you're going to walk down the street and sort of trip upon something that would be a marvelous story that you want to share with other people and put on the radio. You meet somebody. There's never time off. It's a funny thing. You will read an article, and by reflex now, I clip it, I tear it, I underline it, I tuck it away somewhere. I'll meet somebody at a party, and by reflex, I'll take down a name and phone number because they've said something that makes me think, gee, they'd be fabulous to talk to on the radio, or they're giving me an idea which I want to go and pursue somewhere else. Well, if you have that sort of a mind, and I tend to, a program like All Things Considered is a wonderful receptacle for it, you know, because you catch these little bits of life and can do something with them. They don't just vanish. Oh, wait, in a way, Terry, that's what I like about the book. The book does that same thing. People say, have said often to me, and I bet this happens to you too, gee, radio, we like it a lot, but isn't it frustrating to you that you do it and it's gone? It sort of disappears. I've had, over the years, developed a very sophisticated rap about that. I said, you may think it disappears, but it's very insidious. It gets into your sort of emotional baggage and your intellectual baggage and your psychological baggage, and people carry our voices around in their heads. And there's an interesting kind of cross-fertilization that happens with that. And I believed it until someone said, hey, would you like to do a book that's sort of a scrapbook of the best moments of All Things Considered? And when I heard that, it just something clicked, and I thought, that it would be wonderful to catch that back. You know, just as you, what I was saying before about kind of catching back stories and good ideas as they pass you by in life and putting them on the radio, this was a way of catching back those stories from the radio and onto a page where you could go back and look at them again and take your time and remember that Robert Krulwich series on restaurants. Everybody's got the secret fantasy how to open a restaurant, and he did a wonderful series about it, and that's there. Kim Williams essays and all kinds of, you know, things that have sort of made the heart of the program over these years. Nice to sort of leaf through it and see it again.
What did you discover about the show going through it in the way that you had to put it in the book?
Oh, gee, yeah. And it was an incredible ordeal. You can imagine going through 10 years worth of material. We keep logs, rundowns. I bet you do too. Of every day's program, little quick descriptions of every element on the program. I read through 10 years worth of those things. Can you imagine? I was going cross-eyed and blind. I was amazed, though, how the medium helps you out, because the stuff that was powerful jumped off the page at me. 10 years old it was, and I remembered it. That's how good it was, you know? And so I could grab the tape, go back. A lot of those tapes are in the National Archives. Can you imagine, Terry, along with the Declaration of Independence and the Nixon White House tapes, there's All Things Considered. Go back and pull them out and listen to them again, get them transcribed. Listeners helped to shape this book also. I asked them on the air. I said, I didn't talk about a book, but I said there was going to be some special observation, special celebration of an anniversary, and we needed their help. Would they send in their best memories of what they'd heard on the air? And again, those memories, if they were strong enough, people remember things from 1971, 72, that meant those were tremendously powerful pieces, if you remembered it for that long. And I got a carton full of letters, and the table of contents really was sort of shaped by that. So what I learned, first of all, was that we did a lot of things that were memorable, that people just remembered. And the range of it, too, is what struck me in going over that. That, of course, we did the daily news. And what's so funny is that now we almost take that for granted. I think listeners do, too. They know to turn to us as I am about to say, the most reliable. I think it's true, darn it, I'll say it. The most reliable daily source of news. I think it's true in the country, as far as electronic media go. So they knew that they could come every day for the full story that day on the Falklands, not just the 30-second stand-up spot, you know, not the minute and a half quickie. But if it took 45 minutes, they'd get it from us. And so they tuned to us for that. But they also knew that this was a place where it wasn't just events that we would talk about. We would talk about ideas. We would talk about foolishness. We would give recipes for cranberry relish. And on a day of Three Mile Island and a hideous accident like that, we could also hear a Perla Myers talking about how to prepare rice, and it was okay. You know, it was okay to laugh, and it was okay to be unhappy, and it was okay to really be very smart and ask an intelligent question, and it was okay to be totally naive and not know and ask a truly dumb one, too.
One of the things you cover in the book is what happens at the morning meetings, how
yeah.
the show is put together.
Yeah.
I think those of us who've never been there when the show is put together are endlessly curious about
how
it
do
gets
it.
Done. Would you just briefly sketch out for us, Susan,
sure.
what a typical day at All Things Considered is
sure.
like?
Sure. That's the first chapter of the book. It's called A Day in the Life, and I decided that it should be the first chapter because it's the question that's asked me most. It's also, anywhere I go, the question that interests me most. I love to know about process, and I love to know about behind-the-scenes stuff. How did they do that? How did they get that to work? In some ways, I'd rather go to a rehearsal of an orchestra than to a performance because I learn more. I learn when the conductor stops and starts and tries it again and I hear something grow and evolve. I'm getting to your question, Tara. Don't think I'm evading. I'll speak personally instead of sort of we. I start at home around 7 in the morning with the television on, and I have been, until very recently, watching the CBS Morning News program when Charles Kuralt, who wrote the foreword to my book, exquisite foreword, incredible foreword, when he was hosting it. Now I find there's much less of interest there for me because he was so wonderful and such a marvelous writer. They've had a change in the cast of characters there, and I'm not as interested. But I watch anyway that or the Today Show. I sort of flip my dial between that and also Good Morning America. That while I read the New York Times and the Washington Post, which gets delivered to the house, and wave goodbye to my husband and son as they get off for work and school. So those morning television programs are really a headline service for me. They tell me what's happened overnight. They tell me about news that's broken that we wouldn't have known the night before and things that we're going to have to pay attention to. I'm also sort of moving around the house and listening also to Morning Edition. Do you all run that here?
Mm-hmm. 6 until 8.
Yeah. So that's the place really for good analysis and more useful to me these days than some of those television programs. So that's all preparation, you know, and I'm gathering up notes and I'm picking up books that I read the night before for interviews that I have that day. Get into work around 9:30 or so and make some personal phone calls, pay a couple of bills. I've got 10 minutes for this. And then at 10, we have our morning planning meeting. And the whole staff is a basic core group of 15 people that put All Things Considered together every day. These are Sandy Unger and I, the hosts, Stephen Reiner, the executive producer, Richard Harris, the producer, Maurice Schlesinger, our director. These names maybe will be familiar to regular listeners because we give them in the closing credits at the end of every day's program. The foreign editor is there. The program sort of national content editor is there. The various people who cut and edit the tapes are there. The research assistants are there. And we hear what's on the docket. We hear what the reporters, the NPR reporters, have lined up for that day. We listen to that list and decide, are there ways that Sandy and I could enhance some of those stories? If Linda Wertheimer is doing a piece on the budget, Sandy and I may want to call someone in Kankakee, Illinois, whose life will be affected by whatever decision is going to be made in the halls of Congress that day. Then we listen to what we talk about what the foreign news is and talk about stories that are in the works from stringers all over the world. And again, talk about ways in which Sandy and I, as the host of the program, can enhance or lead or, you know, do whatever needs to be done. Questions, unanswered questions. That's what it's about. That's what those meetings ought to be about. Not just here's what happened today, but what does it mean that it happened? And if that happened today, what could happen tomorrow? And what happened 4 weeks ago that should have let us know that it was going to happen today? So it's all of that at a good meeting, and they're not all good. We get real tired. You know, he's going to slump in, and I write about that too with the half-eaten donuts and the old styrofoam cups full of coffee. And we're tired and we're kind of a little sluggish and it's hard to get going. But on a good day, there's just terrific energy and electricity in that room and a good exchange of ideas and disagreements and arguments.
What might you argue over?
Oh, whether I'm just let me try to think of a recent argument. Whether we're blowing up the Falklands story, whether we've gone too long on Falklands, or whether we were paying too much minute by minute attention to it when it was really in a holding pattern. I think, in fact, we were. So we cut back for a couple of days, and we just, instead of five stories on Falklands, we'd do three, you know, and that, but we'd argue about that, we'd discuss it, and there'd be some good lively interchange. Anyway, so that, the meeting lasts for about an hour, and then Sandy and I tell what we've got to do, and then we go about doing it. From 11 o'clock on, we spend our day making the program. Everything is pre-recorded pretty much by the time we go on the air at 5. And Sandy and I are there live introducing the tapes that we and others, all the reporters, people at the member station, have spent the day making. So the real work of the day is done from 11 to 5 o'clock. And it only occurred to me very recently that 5 o'clock is the time to relax. I mean, there's always the chance that there will be some late-breaking story which will send you scurrying like me, but it's very unusual. You know why? Because newsmakers know about media deadlines. Isn't this pathetic? And they know if they want to make their news and they want to get it on the nightly news that night, television mostly, and they want to be on television, they better make it by 2 o'clock or their chances are very slim. This is the way the world is operating these days.
I think sometimes that All Things Considered is truly at its best in times of emergency or tragedy, catastrophe.
Do you? How interesting.
That's when I know that I really have to tune it in.
Oh, that's
wonderful. I try to tune it in, but when something awful is happening and I really need to make sense of it,
yeah,
just for, you know, for like personal security as well as
that's a
professionally
place you'll
turn. To know, that's where I'll turn. And it's funny that such terrible things make for such important programming, and I wonder how you
terrible
feel like
events.
That.
I'll tell you, but news, oh, it's so complicated. Yeah, at a time of 3 Mile Island, you need to go to a news organization whom you've built a relationship with for years. You know you can trust them. I mean, you turn to the New York Times because you know what kind of an operation that is. Hopefully, you turn to National Public Radio, too, for that same thing. You know we will not rush onto the air with information unless it's been very carefully checked and unless we can present it in some kind of shape and form. So, yes, it's that kind of reassurance, and you turn at that point to people you could trust, and you know they won't go hysterically rushing onto the air with the first bulletin. You know what, Terry? That, in a way, is the easiest thing for a first-rate news organization to do. I hate it. It's my least favorite kind of broadcasting. I hate that kind of pressure and that kind of quick, you know, deadline sort of stuff and when the adrenaline goes. It's not my style, really. I like to sit back. I like the time to prepare. I like the time to think and to analyze and get something good on the air, not quick on the air, not fast on the air. Good, solid, substantive. But in a way, that's easy. It's quick and dirty. It's infinitely harder to take a story like the hostages in Iran, which went on forever, and do it day after day after day with no crisis, you know, with no daily boom except when that abortive rescue attempt. But when the story continues, or the one in Poland, the conflict with Solidarity, to go day after day and be steady with it and keep going back to it and find new things to say about it, that's much harder. To sustain it over the long haul, that's the test of a news organization, not how quickly they can and reflexively they can react to an event. Mm-hmm. Events news is easy. Bill Seymour, said something so wonderful to me about this. I must repeat it. He said, I hate this distinction between hard and soft news. Hard, the idea of events news versus soft, Mama's Danbury's cranberry relish or whatever. He says, because hard news really should be called easy news. Has he ever told you this, Terry, or has he given this little speech to the staff of WUHY? He says it should be called easy news because it's so easy. The hard news from the White House is the easiest thing to gather. The White House correspondents hang out at the White House all day waiting, A, to be briefed, B, for the free handouts, all printed and neat, and all they have to do is write from it. not enterprise reporting. There's very little original reporting and news that they can do from there for all the glamorousness of that beat. It's sort of easy news.
You say in your book that you try to find the novel within the news story.
Yes.
I don't mean the new, but like the literary novel.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's the old English major in me. I don't know, maybe it's fancier than I can explain or analyze to you, but I come to news from a background in the arts, in the humanities. I still sketch for relaxation, and I still play the piano. And what I really love to do is read novels. It's what I did in college as an English major. And I come to events of life with that, against that background. I'm not a journalist in that formal way, and I've never had any fancy journalistic training. So what I want to know when hostages are taken is what difference does it make to the life of Mrs. Moorfield out in, San Diego, California. I look there for the drama and the conflict. I'm not looking for cheap thrills, you know, that kind of dramatic stuff very much at all. But I want to know the difference that that event is making in her life. I want to know the difference it's making in all of our lives as citizens living here, the idea that that many Americans are being held in some foreign country by a very frightening group of people. What does that tell us about ourselves? How does it change our perceptions of ourselves? So it's that I mean, that kind of tension and conflict and the effect on personality and character is the most, much more interesting to me. And I come to news that way. Something else I wrote was when I did a national call-in with President Carter. I sat for 2 hours in the Oval Office with him while people all over the country phoned in. People afterwards said to me, gee, that must have been the high point of your career. And I said, well, not at all. I suppose it should be. And for real journalists, I guess it would be that chance to sit with the President of the United States for 2 hours. But I was far more absorbed by changes in his eyes and what happened to his complexion when he was dealing with a difficult question and how his posture changed and he sat up straight or he clenched his hands, much more than any of the words he was speaking, because those were words he'd spoken a lot before, many, many times before. But that glimpse of character, that to me was special, and that's what interests me the most.
One of the things that is very special about your interviews is the kind of rapport you're able to build with the people who you're speaking to. You're pretty close to people, both newsmakers and artists and
yeah,
people
I'm not
who
scared
you're
of them.
Reaction.
Thank you. I take that as a compliment. I'm
oh,
not
it's
scared
meant
much.
To be one. But I wonder how you try to balance that with politicians and newsmakers, that desire to build rapport, but the kind of journalistic distance that you need to keep with someone who might be very manipulative of the rapport that's built.
I don't know. Trying to think of some example. What's rushing to my mind is how good Sandy is at that, Sandy Younger. And he tends to interview politicians a heck of a lot more than I do. I'm not terribly interested in doing it, mostly because for some of the things you said, I like to get inside people. And I don't think politicians are going to let me inside much. They're going to tell me as much as they want to reveal to me and nothing more. I'm not interested in fancy exposés. You know, I don't care about that. And I respect people's privacies and don't want to invade it. But they're not going to tell me anything they haven't said 700 times before. And I get the feeling with them that they're just pushing the buttons on cassettes, pre-recorded cassettes in their heads, and whatever comes out, they will tell you. He's terrific, though, Sandy, at breaking through that somehow. And I'm not quite sure. He's very quick. And he doesn't mind a good fight. He's a good fighter. And he doesn't mind scrambling up with people. And this may be a sex issue again, I'm not crazy for fighting. You know that? And I think women, maybe we have it harder as journalists because we're raised, you're younger than I am, maybe this is not your experience, we're raised to be nice girls. You know, you don't, everything a journalist is, which ought to break a lot of rules and be not always, not have a bad case of the for reals. That's Sandy's expression. I think it's terrific. Not always accept what's shown you, but raise a lot of questions and be disobedient and not be so ladylike and not be so polite. I sometimes think it's hard for women to sort of toe those marks, meet those demands that journalism makes of you, not accept the easy answer, push for something more. And in some ways, I think he's quite successful at it. My approach is different, and mine is to disarm in a way. That sounds manipulative, and I don't mean it that way. I'm just much more comfortable in quiet conversation or laughing hard, you know, having a good time and joking, than I am in confrontation. So the other example that I think of was John Ehrlichman, which Bob Edwards and I interviewed him after he had gotten out of jail and was going around touring with his first novel. And I was as scared before that interview as I've ever been in connection with radio. And I'll tell you why. I felt we covered Watergate so thoroughly and so carefully, and all through it, I felt he was the one that seemed to me the most malevolent, the one who would be most deceptive and most dishonest. I've changed my view of him, by the way, in recent years and sort of reading new writings of his and seeing the kind of change that he himself has gone through. But at that time, I was very frightened. And I thought ahead, how am I going to do this interview? How will I do it? If I do it in a prosecutorial fashion, it'll be, you ever see two dogs worrying over a towel? You know, each gets the towel and they shake their heads back and forth. And that's what it'll be. Plus, I don't have that kind of mind. I cannot commit to memory every page of the White House transcripts and be able to say to him, but Mr. Ehrlichman, on the 3rd of June, you said blap, and on the 27th of June. I just can't. My mind doesn't work that way. So I sort of discarded all of that and thought, I'll do what I can do. And that is ask him extremely soft-sounding questions, which ended up, things like, Mr. Ehrlichman, tell me what happens when you go, you live in Santa Fe, and you drive up to a gas station for gas. You drive your car and you say, fill them up, and they realize who you are. What's the reaction you get? Questions, just real personal ones like that. Not, aren't you ashamed of yourself, leading the nation down this thorny path? None of that. Just, what's it like for you? How's your life? And it ended, I don't remember the specific question that I asked, but it ended with something that he said that was more revealing to me about Watergate than I could have gotten with 7 hours of, really mean questions. He said at the end, let me tell you something about Washington. In this town, there's one king of the mountain, and everybody else in this town is out to shoot him off that mountain. That's Washington. That was Watergate in a nutshell. That was all the paranoia of the Nixon White House right there. And if I'd said to him, weren't you all terribly paranoid in that White House? He never would have said anything like that. So sometimes, just through that sort of softer approach, that comes. I like listening to good arguments on the air. I'm just not very good at it. Sandy's good.
Did it ever happen to you that someone who you really cared for and respected turned out to not be an interesting interview, and you kind of felt that for the sake of your listeners, you should erase the tape, but for the sake of this person, you didn't want to hurt their feelings and not play it?
What a wonderful question. I guess I won't answer your question because something else is occurring to me, so let me tell you this story. I think I won't name a name, but it was a time when I had to go and interview a writer whose work I very much respected, and I got to see the writer, and we talked for hours, and everything, I'm trying not to even reveal sex, let alone identity in all of this, the writer would talk and go on and on and on and on and on and on and go into a million different directions and corners and angles, and I couldn't make any sense out of what was being said. Sentences would never be finished. Ideas never completed. And I got home with days worth of tape and said to myself, what am I going to do here? This is a writer of major talent, but clearly some damage has been done, some emotional damage or something. Why reveal that? Here's my choice here. It's journalistically dishonest for me to clean up this tape, to build in through editing a logic that in life was not there. On the other hand, look at the harm to do. For what end? To simply present this kind of rambling to listeners. It will neither edify them nor enlighten them, nor really be true to the spirit of the person. So I ended up doing a fairly careful edit in which on tape the person came out far more logical than in life that person was. But I guess it was troubling enough to me that I'm telling it to you now, because there was a certain kind of dishonesty too, that it wasn't real. It was edited. Then again, life, unedited life is fairly rambling and has very little shape or proportion to it, and editing sort of imposes that structure on it. But it was troublesome to me, Terry, I'll tell you. It still bothers me, that kind of choice. And it happens all the time, often.
This was a dramatic example.
No, never, because I knew there were wonderful moments on it. And the truth of the person came through, as a matter of fact. There was enough of that sense of rambling and kind of disorganization that you got that, but not so much that you would end up throwing your hands up in the air and saying, why do I have to listen to this? Because there were good nuggets there, useful nuggets. But that's interesting. These are problems. It's such a good question, because they're problems that we face, I think.
Do you like to interview friends? Like if a newsmaker or
No, I don't at all. It makes me quite uncomfortable. And
me
here's
too.
What do you too?
I hate it. Yeah.
I'll tell you what
hard,
I do. I bend over backwards the other way. Haynes Johnson from the Washington Post said something marvelous during the last presidential campaign when Ted Kennedy was doing so badly. He said he felt the reason was that journalists were so aware of their pro-Kennedy bias that they bent backwards the other way and gave him an even tougher time than they would have any other candidate, just to make sure that they didn't go overboard. And I think in some ways the same thing happens with the president now, maybe not at this moment, but certainly in the early days, that certain reporters who just couldn't stomach him were aware of that kind of antagonism and bent backwards the other way. I guess it was Anthony Lewis, had a wonderful column about that some months back, chiding the press for it and saying, how come the kid gloves here? This man has gotten us this much, many billions of dollars into debt, and the deficit looks like this, and this many people are unemployed, and how come nobody is taking him on? How come? We reporters are just being so soft-gloved. And speculated it was probably because of a fear of an accusation of a real bias, bending the other way. That's what I do with friends. I tend to be tougher and meaner on them because I'm so uncomfortable. Mostly I tend not to interview friends. It happens from time to time, but rarely. I don't like to do it.
What do you think it is that sometimes people who don't know you at all, even though they might know you professionally, like if they listen to the show, will be willing to tell you, an interviewer, things that they might not, like tell someone in their family or tell a good friend? Because happens.
No, I don't think so. I think people know I respect them. And I don't want to know things they wouldn't tell. I don't want to make my living off invading their privacy or ripping off their emotion. I'm not interested in that. But I do believe, Terry, that everybody has a story to tell. I do think that's right. And it's sort of my job to help them to tell it as best they can. If I can create an atmosphere in which they feel comfortable and relaxed and can be more articulate maybe than they ordinarily would be, or easier in front of this bizarre instrument here of a microphone, then great, because it's such an artificial situation. If I can make it less artificial for them and relax them so they get across their best word, their best message, that's terrific. But I don't think they tell me. I hope they don't tell me things that they wouldn't tell their closest friends. I hope not.
What will you do if you want someone to talk about something but you're not sure if it's going too far? You don't want to put them on the spot? Do you ever do that?
I'm really awfully careful about that. I tend not to. The closest, in the book has an example of the favorite interview I ever did, and it's with Joan Didion. And it's a long thing. It was a half an hour on All Things Considered, and the book must be about 12 or so. How many pages is it? I never counted. But it's long. And that, I liked it so much because it stopped being a radio interview and just simply became two women talking to one another. We lost any kind of self-consciousness about being overheard or being across from a microphone. But she talks there, and I do too, about that whole business of intimacy and the questions that reporters do or don't ask. And she says she could never bring herself to ask the simplest questions that any reporter can ask, like, how much money do you earn? She said, and she thought she realized as a result that she was just so misplaced as a reporter. I mean, she couldn't do those simple things. And she says too in the book that she's never more relieved when she goes out on a story as a journalist. Now, she does wonderful journalism as well as her novels. Never so relieved when she goes out on a story as when the person she's sent to interview is too busy to be able to do the interview. So she just gets to ride along with them and observe them, which she'd far prefer to do, because she says the interview itself is terrifying too, and she really doesn't want to do it, and only does it as a formality for what else she can pick up.
Were you ever shy?
I'm always shy. I'm usually shy. How do you like that?
I'm surprised.
Isn't everyone, Terry? We just have different ways of covering it up. Sure.
Do you think that being heard nationally on All Things Considered has changed your personality in any way?
Oh, no. Really? No.
No, I'm asking
changed
you.
Changed my personality.
Because, you know, even if you think of yourself as a shy person, you're forced to confront people every day and speak with people who are famous and people who have never been near a microphone and need to be put at ease. And it's kind of all like your responsibility to...
I feel quite responsible.
Yeah.
Always.
So has that changed you in any noticeable way, do you think?
Gee, I hope not. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I've always felt fairly easy with people.
Like, do you deal with people differently at parties now, for instance?
No. But here's something a friend said to me once, and this is an old friend from high school, Susan, whenever we would come to your house for sleepovers, you'd keep us up all night talking. So clearly, you know, I was in training for this from around the age of 12 without knowing it, that I always asked questions. I always wanted to know and analyze and understand how things worked. I always had that curiosity. And so I guess I haven't changed. I just found the natural resting place for it, you know, the place best suited for it, and that kind of flittering curiosity that I have.
Do you dream a lot? Do you have nightmares about All Things Considered? You know, about, like, the mic's turned on and you're not there?
No, I've never had that. Sandy was telling me he had one of those the other day. How was it? Oh, I wish I could remember how his went. No, I don't have those much, but everybody does around. I must have years ago. I don't these days, but everybody's got those anxiety dreams. And someone, a psychiatrist I interviewed once, told me that those are really reassurance dreams, and they're very good for you. That is, if you dream the fear, when you wake up, you realize, oh, it was only a dream. It didn't really happen. And that comforts and reassures you. So you've sort of gotten it out of your system. Isn't that interesting?
That's right.
I still have the recurrent. I went to Barnard College in New York, and I went back there a couple years ago to give a speech. And I was in this room full of Barnard alums. It was on a reunion day. Must have been 200 of them. And I was to talk about the danger of, you know, some very lofty title with a colon in it. You always have colons in your titles at Barnard. And also in papers that you write at Barnard, then you get A's when you put a colon in the title. So it had some fancy title. The danger of fragmentation of information, you know, the overload of information. And I had this nicely typed speech I was ready to give. I looked out in that room full of women, and I couldn't contain myself. I felt it was such a captive audience. I said, who here has had the Barnard dream? That's all I said. Hands shot up all over this gymnasium. And I looked at him and I said, you know what I mean, don't you? Here's the dream. You've graduated Barnard College, which is in New York City. It's the women's equivalent of Columbia University. And somebody finds out that you owe 3 credits in math. Or you didn't do, or you owe 4 credits in phys ed or something. You know, they found that out. And you should have seen, I didn't have to define what that dream was. They all knew it and they'd all had it. So everybody's got those kinds of things. There must be All Things Considered dreams. Do you have those?
Oh, I have them all the time.
What happens? Do you lose your voice or the microphone is unplugged? Or?
Well, the one that I've had recently a few times is that somehow there's like a 3.5 minute record on.
Yeah.
And it's about 2 minutes through. And I neither have a guest to interview nor another record to play. And I know my choices are running to get another record or to find a guest, in which case the record will run out.
Oh.
That's already on and no one will be there to say anything. Or staying there to outro the record. But, of course, I'd have to talk for hours until 5 o'clock because there's no follow-up.
Tara, I'm going to leave the room and take all your records away. Let's see what you do. You may as well get over this dream.
Yeah.
Confront it, Terry. Get through it.
I should explain to our listeners why we are hearing Susan's voice. Now, Susan's visiting Philadelphia. I know you're used to hearing her at 5 o'clock. Today is the 11th anniversary of All Things Considered, for which, Susan, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's the pub date of Susan's new book, Every Night at 5, Susan Stamberg's All Things Considered book, and congratulations again. And that's published by Pantheon. What do you do, and I think this happens to every interviewer, when you like the writer, but you don't like their new book that the interview's based on.
Well, that happened, as a matter of fact, with Joan Didion. And I write about that in my book, as a matter of fact. I discovered in preparing, she was one of my favorite writers and has been for years. In fact, I hadn't known anything about her until the first week I set foot in the studios of National Public Radio. And someone on the staff, a fellow named Doug Terry, said, read this woman's stuff. She's fantastic. And it was Diddy, and it was her first collection of essays called Slashing Towards, because it's British, so it's got an S on the end, Slashing Towards Bethlehem. Took him home and thought, oh, my Lord, I've never read reporting like this. It's sensational. Well, years later, that must have been around 71, 77 or 78, she went on a book tour, her only one. Terry, I've got to cough. Do you have a cough button, or must I blast your poor listeners' ears?
I think the latter.
Excuse me, listeners. I'm going to turn my head away now. Send lozenges and honey, please, or chicken soup. So in 77, in preparation for interviewing her, I got out everything. And she was touring with the novel, her last novel, A Book of Common Prayer. Got out the first collection of essays, got out all the early novels. And I guess that was all. The White Album came out later. Reread them and found, in fact, that I didn't like the novels very much at all. Here's what I did, though. That opened up the whole interview for me. It gave me a talking point. That is, I trusted those reactions. I trusted that response. I knew, I felt that the journalism was first rate, what she did. Something else, so her powers of observation of life were wonderful. Something else was happening between her page and me when she went to make fiction. And I asked myself what it was. What is distasteful to me here? What am I not liking? And what I found was, in figuring that out, a point of view, a talking point for when she came in the studio. She was saying there's a void at the center of experience, and that's normal. I felt that's horrible. She thinks there's a void at the center of experience. Ugh, that's a nightmare. I don't like that. So we had a terrific interchange about it because I went in with that viewpoint. You can always, you know, you don't need to be polite in front of these microphones. You should trust your responses and your natural reactions and your own intelligence and figure, why am I reacting that way? Well, if I am, I'm not alone. I'm like a whole lot of other people. So I'll make that a talking point. Let me work with that. Let me use that. And writers, gee, boy, they appreciated someone taking them so seriously that they formed an opinion about the work. What? That's nothing's more flattering. Oh, sure, they've got egos. How do you like that? Because now I wrote a book, I can say I'm a writer too. And you want to please people and have them think that what you've done is terrific. But also it's wonderful that someone else has taken the time to think so hard about something you've worked so hard at. And that's exciting to start to talk about and to explain yourself. And that's also exciting then for listeners to hear.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about when you look at your television counterparts who are anchoring or hosting news shows?
I'm not very interested in them. I often have a hard time telling them apart. Don't you? What I notice about television is that, here's a funny thing. I'm in Philadelphia, and last night I watched your local TV news, and I thought I was in Washington. I could probably, when I go to Chicago, have that same feeling that everybody's so interchangeable. They look alike. They talk alike. They present the same sorts of stories. I feel they're quite plastic, and I don't, well, I guess I do know why. I think everybody that goes on television is given this little list of don'ts. Don't nod your head. Don't smile. Don't move your face around. Don't be too mobile. Don't use big gestures. Don't. Sit up straight. Don't have a double chin. And they memorize the list, and they end up all the same. So there's no room for real distinctiveness. Very few. Kuralt is one. You know, but there are a handful of them who really have something special and individual. Well, you feel there's somebody at home there in that brain. You know, there's someone inside there.
What did you think of television when you did TV All Things Considered?
Not a whole lot. I don't know. That program was okay. And listeners wrote and said interesting things to us. They said, we loved seeing you on television. It was so much fun to see what you look like. They're saying the same thing to me about the book because there are pictures of the staff and the reporters in the book, and it's sort of fun for them to see what we look like after all these years. So that they liked. They said they liked the program too. But then, and with a real note of concern, please don't stop doing radio. So that feeling on listeners' part that this medium is very special, very distinctive, that we're doing it in a way that's unique, and we should continue doing it. Don't get lured or don't fall into the trap of feeling somehow doing it on television means we're legitimized, you know, that that's the big time. I don't think it is. You know, this to me is a much more exciting medium than television, which I find quite limiting and confining. So I didn't think it was a nice television program. But I don't think it can touch our daily work. I really don't.
How did you feel being seen?
I don't mind being seen. But I don't like talking to a camera. I have a real hard time with that. I can't smile at a machine. I mean, it strikes me as absurd to try to smile at a machine. And I feel fake and phony. Most of the time, I try to be quite genuine. And I don't like having to be fake. And that feels fake to me. Some people are wonderful at it, though. Genuinely can do it. Jane Pauley on the Today Show. Oh, boy, can she talk to a camera. And there's a terrific expression I learned about that. It's called break through the glass, the television expression. And Jane Pauley does it. She breaks through the glass. She gives you the illusion as a viewer that there's nothing between you and her. That's a great talent. And that other fellow, Brian, what is his name?
Brian Gumbo.
My son calls him Brian Gumbo, the fellow who works with her on the Today Show is very good at that, too. But, gee, there are so few of them that can do it and make you believe that they're genuinely there talking. Anyway, I think that's a skill one can develop. You know, I think I could probably do that. But it doesn't fascinate me as a medium the way radio does. I'll do it, though, because it's there. You know, I'll do more.
You've done a lot of interviews on parenting and the difficulties of holding a job and being a parent at the same time. And, of course, you are a mother as well as a national news anchor. Does doing the interviews help in real life?
I wish.
You've done the interviews.
Well,
does it make your life easier?
Listen, this is the wonderful thing about All Things Considered. I was very self-conscious in the early days about the extent to which my own sort of personal interest in hobby horses ended up on the radio. When I started working, my boy was a year and a half old, and I was doing a lot on childcare, and I was talking with Chaim Ganat every other week about advice and discipline and how you do it. Now Sandy Unger has a baby. Oh, thank you. Some kind person has brought me tea. I must sound worse than even I sound to myself. Sandy Unger has a baby. And by gum, if we're not getting childcare pieces back on All Things Considered. And the executive producer, Stephen Reiner, who's just so good, he's just a dream of a producer, said the other day, you know what's so wonderful about this program is that we follow our hobby horses. And when a host is having a baby and having growing up pains with that baby, it's a part of life, and it's not just the host needing to find out the right answer for his child. It's think how many new parents there are listening to this program, and let's make room on the program for that kind of conversation. So sure, Josh has grown up with this program. My husband and I have grown up with this program. People do, and we follow our own interests, assuming there are a lot of people out there like us who will share those interests. You can't only do that, and we have to meet other needs too. But it's so nice to be able to do that as well.
So it's helped you balance responsibilities to have spoken to the experts about it?
I guess so. You know, everybody, I don't know. We sort of went through that tyranny of expertise for a while here. Now I can say after 12 years, maybe I begin to know how to be a mom. I wasn't so sure in the beginning. It's something you learn. Funny, Terry, it's the most important job you'll do in your life. And we go into it as absolute rank amateurs, generation after generation of total amateurs to do this hard work. So you learn every year as you learn how to make radio programs and you learn the rest of it. But yeah, I guess as a new mother, an early mother, I depended a whole lot more on those experts than I do now. Now I sort of maybe know what I'm doing, but soon he'll be a teenager and then it's all up for grabs. And you can expect on All Things Considered to hear interview after interview about how you deal with teenagers.
Has it been hard for you to find time in your life
of
for
course,
family?
Of course. And anybody who tells you it's not is not telling you the truth. They're lying. And I was going to say it's particularly hard on women, but my husband is incredible, incredibly supportive, and it's absolutely shared. I can't tell you how we are both of us mothers and we are both fathers to that child. It's an equal sharing, equal partnership. It didn't happen overnight. It took lots of years of sort of negotiating and finding those ways. But you're always robbing somebody to pay somebody. That is, there always something has to, every day, goes on the back burner. The day that Josh had measles, All Things Considered, sat on a back burner. The day that Lou had a job problem, Josh, you know, it's constant juggling. And people who tell you it's not or it's easy are just being dishonest to you. It's one of the toughest things, and it takes terrible toll. It's an awful strain. Sometimes you just have to pull yourself away and give total attention there, and I'll probably always feel, well, we adjust our lives, though. We live like hermits. The hours are very long. I don't get home till about 7 at night. So weeknights are absolutely family time, and weekends are absolutely family time. That's changing now as Josh gets older and has more social obligations and sort of social dates that he makes. But until very recently, that's how we've lived. We've just said this is enormously important. Time is working against us with the job and how absorbing. And Lou's job is absorbing also. But we'll find our way and we'll just do it like this. But it's never, you're never easy with it, ever. You know, there's always something pulling. It's just the hard, I think raising a child is the hardest thing you could do. After that, writing a book, and after that, I don't know. Keeping all these things going, it's real hard.
You mentioned in your book that your husband picks you up from the State Department where he works at the end of the day. Are there things that you try not to talk about with each
what
other?
What do you mean?
Since he's at the State Department and you have
top-level security
stuff? Right,
yeah. Oh, no.
No.
Although there are marriages like that. There are journalist marriages like that. That doesn't happen with us. Oh, no. He's just... No, not a bit of it. He's fascinated in what I do. He's more interested in news than I am, really. You know, I said he loves all of that. So he's very good in for bouncing ideas off of. And he doesn't tell too many high-level secrets. I'm after him all the time to tell me secrets, but he rarely does. I don't think he knows too many.
Do you ever wish that you were in the same profession? Because I'm sure you've seen a lot of people who are in couples who are in the same profession.
I wish so because he's so terrific. I'll tell you. I mean it. He's so smart and good. I keep telling him always, I wish he'd come and be foreign editor of All Things Considered to be sensational. He said, I couldn't work with you. He wouldn't do it. I'd go in a minute. I would.
Who are some of the interviewers who you listen to and really respect?
Terry, there are not a whole lot. It's a real short list.
Can you listen to other interviews? Because I would
no,
imagine
because I'm always hearing
so
follow-up
that,
questions,
yeah,
and I'm always hearing the question I would ask that they're not asking the questions that they miss.
It's like a lot of musicians go home and will not listen to music.
Yeah, they just can't.
Yeah.
And I don't, Moyers, obviously, he's just wonderful, and he interviews with his heart as well as his brain, which I think is really important. There are very few. I like to hear Sandy Unger's interviews. I mean, there's a handful of them that I think are any good. There aren't too many models.
Your book,
isn't that sad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your book, Every Night at Five, has just been published, and in doing it, you've had to go through interviews and reports, things that exist in the world of sound, and make them into print.
Yes.
What did you learn about the difference between sound, radio, and print in doing that?
The thing I worried about most at the beginning, because it is a collection of transcriptions of some of the best pieces from the program, is that they wouldn't hold up on the page. And a lot of them don't. And by definition, the things that are purest radio didn't make it into the book. I'll give you an example. The things were where the story is sound. The other day, a couple of weeks ago, we just did this silly thing on All Things Considered. We got so intrigued in following the Falklands debate in the British Parliament by the sound of that Parliament. I don't know if you heard this the other day. We loved all the loyal opposition and the supporters all going, rubbish, rubbish, resign, resign. You ever hear the sound of the British Parliament as Margaret Thatcher would get up and speak? We got so intrigued, we decided to create our own Parliament. And I was Margaret Thatcher. And I created a totally innocuous speech, which said things like, today is Wednesday, the 7th of April, and the sun rose this morning. And we amassed in the studio loyal opposition. Sandy was the leader of the opposition, and he would yell, will the gentle lady yield? And others yelled, resign, resign. And I'd say, and the sun will probably set tonight. Rubbish, rubbish. We just recreated. It took 30 seconds on the air. It was so much fun. It was a nice break from terribly grim news. It was a way to play and have some fun. And that's something All Things Considered does a lot. That'd never make it into a book. It's not particularly funny when I tell it to you. You know, you sort of had to be there and hear it in sound. So those kinds of things. Robert Krull, which is mice. You know, he uses mice, which is the sound of our voices played back at double speed on tape. Some of them sound like this. We're talking very fast. To show, to demonstrate the economy heating up. Well, how do you, you know, if you write in a book, now Robert Krull, which plays mice. That's going to be absurd. So that couldn't make it. So what ends up in there are the things that most heavily depend on language. So you can have a long interview with Joan Didion or John Irving or John McPhee, the only interview we ever granted for broadcast. And Terry, you did that. Did you know that you are responsible? You did know that, didn't you? We should tell our listeners.
Well, actually, what happened was that we had invited Noah.
Yes.
Noah Adams down to co-host an edition of Fresh Air during a fundraiser. Because admiring him very much, we figured, well, it'll be nice to have him here. And a friend of mine had told me that he liked McPhee's writing a lot. So we hooked up an interview with his anthologizer.
Yeah.
And it gave him eventually entree to McPhee because he'd asked such really wonderful questions that revealed
how much
he knew.
That's right. And you did that. You heard Grace. Thank you very much. And it ends up in the book. So interviews with people like that. People who live with words and language, that will hold up and be marvelous in a book. Essays and commentary written by writers.
Do you write differently, Susan, for the page than you do when you're talking?
Yeah, I started to.
Yeah, what's the difference?
Isn't that funny? Oh, should I grab my book
sure,
and see
yeah,
if I can remember something?
Yeah, or...
Well, someone sent chicken soup. What is our address here? Someone will show up.
It would arrive too late.
Because I have a wonderful editor at Pantheon, Sarah Burchtel, and she would stop me a lot and say, Susan, wait, that's radio writing. That's not Am I hitting your microphone? No. Look, now that I look at it, when I started writing for radio, I wrote as I speak. That is, you know, if I write essays for myself, I would write them as I talk and in the rhythm of speech. And here's something from the beginning of the book, the introduction, in which I did sort of write like that. And it seemed to work on the page, although a lot of people found it jarring. This is from A Day in the Life of All Things Considered. And I wrote it in real short sentences, like speech. Here's how it starts. Did it land yet? It's 2 p.m, and I am making my daily joke. No one ever laughs. They're right. It's not much of a joke. I'm simply trying to break the tension. 2 o'clock is the most difficult hour of the day. You hear how short those sentences are, and people said, that's not writing. Make it longer. Writing is longer sentences. No, I said, it's okay. It's my sort of funny, jarring rhythm, and it's like a bunch of rim shots, sort of, they're right. That's one whole sentence. It's not much of a joke. Boom, that's another sentence. I can't say that that's great writing. I mean, this ain't literature, this book. But you know what happened? A strange thing. By the end of it, I think I was on the edge of learning how to write, learning how to say things in written words rather than simply spoken ones. And something I found, Terry, in the course of taking some of these pieces and transcribing them into print, was what work it was. I thought it would be sort of a simple editing task. It turned out to be almost massive rewriting because people do not finish their sentences. If you transcribe what I'm saying right now, it would be a garbled mess. I'm not speaking in complete sentences. I'm certainly not speaking in paragraphs, and I'm not punctuating. So there was all of that work to do. And still,
scary thing, Susan, I think you are. I think you are speaking
no, ma'am.
In complete sentences.
No. Well, let's stop. We'll transcribe.
That's right. See what happens. You know how some people say, oh, she's got a great radio voice, or he's got a great radio voice.
Yeah.
Does that mean anything
no,
to you?
No, I think it's silly, and I'm always embarrassed to be complimented for my voice. I was born with that. I like to be complimented for my brain, my heart, those things.
What's it like for you when you meet people? Like now you'll be traveling around the country, you'll be meeting a lot of people, but I know that you're already used to that. And people who've never seen a photograph of you, I'm sure,
always
get exactly what you look
yeah,
like.
Sure. And they always say the same thing to me. You're so tall. I didn't expect you to be so tall. I am tall. I'm about 5'9". Otherwise, when they sit and think about it, they say, well, you don't look like I expected you to look, but now that I think about it, you really look like you ought to. Bob Edwards, they used to get mad at him and tell him he didn't look like he should look because they wanted him to be 55 years old, short, rotund, with a three-piece suit. In fact, he's tall, lanky, and in his early 30s and wears dungarees a lot and T-shirt. I don't know. It's dangerous to tamper with that image, though.
Do you like being recognized, particularly say you're on vacation, you're getting away from it all?
Sometimes I do.
You?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes it pleases me. Our listeners are quite wonderful, the people who recognize us, because they respect our privacy. And there's something really nice about it. It's not exploitation, and it's not. And sure, I work hard, and I like recognition for it. I think it's just wonderful.
In about 2 minutes, we're going to be joining National Public Radio.
Oh,
for
can
all
I? I
considered.
Get to listen to it. Huh?
What's it like, Susan, when you listen to the show and you're not there?
Oh, I'm hearing. You know, I'm hearing all the edits. That's the thing, and I'm hearing the questions. It happens with All Things Considered as well as anything, but it happens when I listen back to my own work. I hear the things I should have asked. You know, the questions and the emphasis could have been just a little bit better, and that I could have read that line a little better. I'm always constant editing. Hard to turn it off.
Do you wish you were there when you're not there? When you hear
sometimes.
Someone else doing the show?
Yeah, sometimes. Not. I did more at the beginning. Now, we have wonderful people there. I really like listening to that radio program, no matter who's doing it. That's true.
So when you think of how the show has changed, what's the thing that sticks most in
got
your
bigger.
Mind?
It started out, it was a mom-and-pop store. Now it's Bloomingdale's in some ways. That's good, I suppose. It's as long as we keep the intimacy and we don't start getting self-impressed.
Well, Susan, it's been a real thrill for me to be able to speak with you.
Oh, I love talking to you.
I want to thank you a lot for being here.
Thank you. What good questions, Terry. You're a good interviewer.
Well, you're a great guest. Susan Stamberg, congratulations. Her new book has just been published. It's called Every Night at Five, Susan Stamberg's All Things Considered book. It's got a foreword by Charles Kuralt, and it's published by Pantheon. And it's also the 11th anniversary of All Things Considered. And any special celebration coming up we should listen for?
Well, yes. There's an interview of me about my book, and I don't know if it's going to be me interviewing myself. I did an interview with myself, the author, a phoner. The author's on the phone, or it could be Sandy interviewing me. We'll have to listen. Let's listen and see what it is.